This is a really special podcast, and you know, I might say that every time, but I really do feel this way. I am with a friend today. We go way back. He's a colleague. He's also an amazing drone operator, Jeff McMichael. When you're watching Major League Fishing and you see all of that amazing aerial footage, it's being provided by this man right here, Jeff McMichael. But we go way back. This guy is a hell of a videographer as well. He's been in the industry for years and years and years. We're going to have a great talk today. Let's do this.
This isn't another fishing podcast. This is another fishing podcast.
Jeff, I appreciate you coming on another fishing podcast. We, as I said in the intro there, we go way back. And so I wanted to just kind of first get your background a little bit, how we know each other. I think it goes way back to the FLW days, but let's hear your kind of your history from your own mouth.
So I'm one of the old guys now. I've been around a long time, especially with the tournaments. First tournament was 2001, which is crazy to think about. And I think you were like 2004-ish.
Yeah, I was like around somewhere. I want to say I was like around 2003, 2004 when I met you. I was doing FLW stuff for the first time.
Yeah. And so those were kind of different days too. Those were beta cams. Still like it had a different feel to it at those times. Basically with different TV shows that we're doing. The same but different. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, beta cams were these giant. Now we still film with, you know, shoulder mount cameras, right? They're still heavy, but they're nowhere near as heavy as they used to be. The cameras we have now, most of the body is really, is hollow in these cameras. It feels like, you know, so most of the weight is coming from the battery or the lens itself. Back in the day, these Betacam cameras, I'm talking, what are we talking now? 20 years ago. It's crazy.
Yeah.
We're getting old, Jeff. I don't know if you've noticed.
You're getting old.
Yeah. Well, I'm when I look at myself here, I'm and seeing all the gray, I used
Everybody's talking about it.
Cody Prather, who is also a cameraman for Major League Fishing, I used to give him a hard time about his beard and like being so gray, you know, like patchy. And look at here. Now I used to call him a Thundercat. I don't know if you've ever watched Thundercats back in the day. It was a huge, big, popular TV, you know, cartoon series for me when I was growing up. But yeah, like it was a cartoon about like humanoid cats. And they had beards and gray, and the older one had like a gray beard, you know? Yeah, I'm being dead serious now. This is all true. So now I'm looking like a Thundercat. So
Greg, when you first started with FLW, was it where they had the hat cams and the bow cam and everything else? Or was that a couple years later?
It was, you know, it was around that time. I want to say it was probably, it was around that time. They were doing stuff like that. I mean, remember they were doing... Do you remember way back in the day? This is like in the late 90s. They did the M1. You remember that tournament? And it was $1 million. Do you remember the first place guy that won it, won $1 million? Do you remember that they had, like, they were doing hat cams in there too and like trying to do it live? And it was such a cluster, dude. Like, these guys had like giant like packs on their belt, you know?
All had a fanny pack.
They had a heavy fanny pack and this ridiculous, like, it's not like it was a GoPro, you know, back then. I mean,
it was a camera that was inside on top of their hat that all made them cross-eyed because you could see it right here on top of their hat looking over.
Yeah. So no, to answer your question, I didn't really experience that, but I remember seeing it on TV like in 99, and it wasn't until like, I guess, 6 years later or something that I actually started really filming tournaments more. But what were you going to say about that?
So for those, the beta camera was 30 minutes for a tape. You had to change out tape. The hat cam, they had like a little thing, was 60 minutes, and they had a bow cam with a whole deck in the back, and that was 90 minutes. So you had to keep it up for all day long which camera that you need to switch, which tapes you need to switch. So you basically felt like a tape switcher instead of a camera guy.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. And the thing is, like, we the camera guy, so Jeff now, and I was thinking about this last night. I had to talk to you about how this transition happened with you, because you did it very slyly, right? So Jeff was, I mean, he was in the infantry, basically. He was in the front lines. He was in the trenches with us as one of these camera guys that had a heavy camera on their shoulder, you know, filming all day. And then kind of like one day, Jeff is like operating a drone. And then from then on, we never see him. He's operating a drone from now on. And I always wonder, how did you manage that? Honestly, you are actually one of the best cameramen, you know, filming bass tournaments. But you made a very wise, very intelligent move to get into the skies and out of the boat.
That shoulder feels so much better.
Yeah, exactly.
So the first time, actually, I saw the drone guys really early on, even before fishing. There was a guy in Montana that I did a shoot with in Botswana, Africa, who had one of the first. He had a drone and also like a small helicopter. And he got some amazing footage all through Africa. And at that point, I went, ooh, that's going to be amazing. And it's still those times, it was hard to fly. They didn't have a GPS like they do now, so they didn't hover. You're really flying it. Helped him out a couple of those things. Did a couple more things with him in Colorado. And then we hired him and a few other guys for early FLW. And some of the other guys that we hired were great pilots, but I didn't think they were as good of a camera guy. Like, they would get these really long, cool shots, but sometimes we need 20-second, 30-second shots, shots that come down a little more cinematic. And so I talked to Peyote Pearman, who was producing the FLW show at the time, and said, man, I could do this. And so I bought an Inspire 1, practiced a little bit, and then just started. And never looked back.
And so the Inspire, if people don't know, so, you know, it's so DJI is this really the leader in drone technology. I mean, they are, you know, I started dabbling in drones around 2013 because, like you, I mean, I saw the enormous potential. As a fisherman, I saw it as like, wow, this technology is going to give people the chance to essentially have a pocket helicopter. You know, to get these amazing, like all the shots that before drones, you know, you're getting with a helicopter and amazing, epic, incredibly dramatic shots that you'd get with a helicopter. Now, not only could you be getting those shots, you know, just anybody pretty much, you know, with one of these, I mean, obviously it takes real talent to be able to, you're absolutely right. Like, you see these guys that don't have a videography background, or, you know, it's immediately noticeable that they're missing shots or they're missing, you know, wait, but.
Well, the fishing thing is tough too, because it's, you have to know how, like a fishing camera guy, you have to know how to not get in their way, what they're fishing, if they're fishing beds, you don't want to get too loud and scare things off. You don't want to, if they're fishing topwater stuff, you know, you approach it like a camera boat sometimes, and know the guys you get really close to, maybe guys that you're going to spin out a little bit if you get too close to. So it's nice to have that background, especially for fishing stuff.
Well, it's,
knowing what editors need.
Yeah, I mean, it's – When I first, you know, like I said, around 2013 was dabbling at it, you know, DJI was, at that time, you kind of had to make your own quadcopter, you know, at the time, or you can make however many arms you wanted, a hexacopter's 6 arms, or an octocopter's 8, which would give you more, you could lift heavier stuff, you know, heavier cameras. But what DJI did, and they saw the writing on the wall, they're like, we gotta own this market. They were making amazing gimbals. It was two things. Well, there's three things that were kind of happening around that time. well, four things. So you had cameras getting very, you know, big sensors, right? So you're getting these these more affordable cameras that are essentially looking like cinema cameras, like big, you know, like Hollywood cameras. Now that technology is kind of anybody's able to kind of with, you know, with some talent can really make amazing shots with a lot less expensive gear, like less of expensive cameras. Then you got GoPros happening around the same time all this was happening, right? So you had GoPros and putting these, you know, HD cameras, making these HD cameras so small and putting camera angles where they've never been before, you know? And then you had and then you had drones. And then you had gimbals. It was like one of the most, for a videographer, for camera guys, it was like an amazing time. Because you had you had drones happening with the ability to just get amazing camera shots. A god's eye view, essentially, you know? And then and then the gimbal technology, essentially just taking those, you know, that kind of, at first it was almost like that GoPro quality of camera, but putting that on a gimbal, and then the cameras just got better, smaller, and now, you know, the company that was first to really jump on that, DJI, and see the potential of it is the leader now. And what's kind of, I mean, we won't get into this, but what's kind of interesting is that they're a Chinese company. So I really wonder, just like you're seeing with TikTok, people are freaking out about China, how long is the whole DJI thing going to happen? But what are your thoughts?
I've tried other drones, but there's really nothing like the DJI products, which is tough. What they do, how they do, how they handle, they're one step ahead of everyone. And so it's hard to go anywhere else to do anything else.
I think especially with the drone stuff. And it's really interesting to see like the evolution of when they first started, you know, to see when they first came out with that little gimbal, and then they just blew up. And now, yeah, they're the absolute leader. And then their cameras, they're pretty diversified too, you know? Yeah. And so, they're an impressive, very impressive company, but,
Well, so in the old days as an outdoor videographer, basically you had one big camera, started on Beta cameras. And then when the big Veracams, and we do hunting and fishing shows all over the world. And so I've worked in all 50 states, I think up to 26 countries. Crazy. And most of that was back in the day with big cameras. So now as an outdoor videographer, you have to have a camera, sometimes a DSLR for other stuff, a couple GoPros, a drone, other specialty stuff. It's crazy the amount of gear that you have to take with you. And they're all little, so it's not heavy anymore. But it's still just the media management you have to do, all the different stuff that you're kind of expected to have to compete.
Yeah, and no doubt, and I know you can speak to this, Keith, because you've been on some remarkable shoots all over the world. But as outdoor videographers, outdoor field producers really is what we are, but we also know how to, I mean, all of us pretty much just the same way. He knows how to edit. I mean, we're all, most of us are pretty well-rounded. And when you go out on a shoot, especially if you're going, I mean, I guess kind of the most far out shoot I've ever done, like just away from anything, is probably the Northwest Territories. But, you know, just as far as me being hired for a gig. but when you do a shoot like that, you have got to have your I's dotted, your T's crossed. I mean, you cannot have... Like if you forget something, there's redundancy upon redundancy, and it's very nerve wracking. And then, you know, is what you're saying, for outdoor videography in particular, you've got to be a one man band, right? You've got to know how to, you need to obviously know how to operate the big camera, know how to do great underwater, know how now more and more to do aerials, to do drone work. And with all of those things, you need to have all of your equipment. When you go far, far away and your client is counting on you to be able to produce to capture footage for a TV show. I mean, just speak to that. Like how that's an aspect of what we do that's so nerve-wracking. And now with aerial, it's an added potential stressor.
So here's what I tell guys. I always get young guys asking on things. They all think like you're going to try and get the one perfect shot. It's going to be the most amazing thing ever, but it's not. It's a hole. So perfection is the enemy of good. So you want to start with good and start building it up, because the most important thing is to finish. You bring home a product for a TV show. You want a beginning, middle, and end. Someone's paying you to have a whole thing done. So you kind of start first with what your goal is, what you want to accomplish, and then you keep making it better and better. You want to, if it's a hunting show, you want to finish, you want to tell a little bit of the story. It's a fishing deal. You want to show how to get there, what they're doing, what they're fishing, catching some fish. And then after that, you can maybe then you would add some more drone work. Then you could do some underwater stuff. Then you keep making it better and better and better. But you have to have a basic show to start. And that's what some guys don't get. You know, they'll go to some place and things are never going to be perfect. When you go an outdoor shoot, they're never perfect. You're going to have weather conditions. You're going to have some of your gear that's broken, or that the tripod's not quite right. There's something happening to the zoom. Everything you expected to set up this way, it's going to happen that way, and you're not prepared for it. So you just learn how to improvise.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Once you learn to do that, you can do anything. You have to be on your feet and willing to change everything completely on a dime.
Yeah, it's I can't emphasize this enough, like how important it is to be able to just roll with the punches. And because there's been times where, you know, when you're away like from any kind of civilization, and you have to improvise. You might have forgotten something, hopefully not anything big. You know, there's been things where I'm like, oh, I really should have brought that, you know, but you're like, okay, what I can do to remedy this is, and so you know, there's a lot of that that's happened, I think, through our careers, you know, and as a videographer that's continuing to work, you have had to have solved those problems, or you wouldn't be continuing to work in the industry. You know what I mean? So, it's, I love it because it's an adventure. This is why I do videography. I mean, I think we've talked about this too in the past, but we're all kind of cut from the same cloth in that regard. We're freelance videographers, we can't sit down. We can't work in an office. You know, it's against who we are. It's like, it's like this is really kind of the only thing that we could do, because everything else is too kind of restrictive, I think, you know. And we need that sense of adventure and travel and meeting new people and, you know, going to new places. I think it's a huge part of why we do what we do, you know.
Well, the outdoor stuff in particular is different, because I've worked on other reality shows, other shows get hired for, some that the money is better. But there's something about outdoor stuff in particular. One, because you're a one-man band, you're in charge of everything. And it's a weird thing. Like I did a show in the Amazon for Peacock Bass not too long ago. And you're going to fly into Brazil somewhere. They say, you look at your little sheet, this guy's going to pick you up at 1 a.m. He's going to drive you 6 hours across country to a boat. You're going to take a boat for 4 or 5 hours to another little Indian village. Then they're going to help you go across these falls and then go another 3 hours to camp. And you're like, okay. It's not like, so who's this guy? Now, where is he taking me? How are we going through Brazil? I did a shoot in Tajikistan the same way. You're going to drive 17 hours. You're going to meet this guy at the airport. And it's so weird. We're like, yeah, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are the things you do that's like that? It's so weird.
I mean, right. It's really an adventure. I mean, I think to myself, like, I try to, as I've gotten older, I've tried to appreciate that more, you know, and go, okay, Greg, just try to be present in this moment right now. Because as you get older too, you realize that life is actually pretty short. And the older you get, the faster it goes. And you're like, oh man, I really need to like, just try be more present, you know, and enjoy this experience. So I've, you know me, I can be a bit of a bitcher at times, but I do try to, I do also try to realize how wonderful life is as well. And our job really affords those moments to see that, how amazing life is. And we're going to beautiful places and but yeah, it's, I remember one time in I did a shoot in Guatemala, and the hosts were two attractive females, okay? Blonde females. And we were like, I mean, kind of in the middle of nowhere in Guatemala. And we two guys that were complete strangers were going to go, they were going to guide us to iguanas that we could shoot, you know, from a dugout canoe. Yeah. And dude, they're like, okay, you need to follow us. And I got such a creepy feeling. I'm like, we're not going to follow these guys. I'll never forget it. I'm like, no, we're not. We're just calling this thing off right now. And that's the kind of job this is, like, you know, I mean, it's like, you gotta have keep your wits about you, but it's, you know, and there's danger, obviously that situation could have been dangerous, but also, you know, when you're going 70 miles an hour plus, down a canal, a skinny canal, you know, and in a bass boat, but with all that being said, I know the dangers, and to me, it's more dangerous to be in a cubicle. So that's why I do what I do. And I like being surrounded by other people that I think are like-minded, you know?
It's an interesting thing about the fishing tournaments. Most of the time, most of the guys were one-man bands at one time, worked on a fishing show or different things. You might work with another videographer. Occasionally there might be a producer, but usually just you're producing the whole thing. The fishing tournaments, there's 10 other guys that are just like you, that you never work, that has all the same interest and talk about camera gear. That is a really unique thing for us, because most of the times you don't work with lots of other guys.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah, definitely. No, that's true. So I mean, I probably harp on this a little bit too much at times when, you know, when we're on our shoots and stuff. But I really do. There is a brotherhood there, you know. It sounds cliche, but it is a family. And yeah, like we are many times one man bands when we're not doing this kind of work, doing the Major League Fishing stuff or the tournament kind of work, bass tournament kind of work. So it is kind of, you know, it is unique in that way. So yeah, it being around other people that we've all kind of been in the same, you know, in the same battles, and it's also fun just sharing stories, because we're doing very similar work. But speaking of which, you know, you do a lot of cool gigs. You've had a lot of, I would say more than I have, as far as more run-ins with celebrities.
That's right. I'm a big deal, man.
Yeah. So So Jeff is a big deal. Talk about, so like the Bonefish and Bones, what was it called? Bones and...
Originally it was Pirates of the Flats. Pirate. And then they changed it to Buccaneers and Bones.
I totally butchered the name. Did you see how ESPN? I researched before the podcast?
Very good. Buccaneers and Bones is actually kind of a weird name. Pirates of the Flats I liked.
So you were working, that's one example that I know, but I know there's more, but talk about that experience, because that show, it was a fly fishing show, but it you guys had celebrities on there.
So it originally, Yvon Chouinard of Patagonia wanted to do a show for Tarpon and Bonefish Trust. So he pitched it to like ESPN just to promote Tarpon and Bonefish Trust. And they're like, I don't know, maybe. And he's like, well, how about if I bring Tom Brokaw, it was Lefty Crabb, famous fly fisherman.
Yeah.
At that first season, I can't remember, Michael Keaton. There was a few other guys. And as we went later, it was Huey Lewis, not Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, Jim Belushi, And there's a bunch of other guys that came throughout the year that we did that show for 8 years. And it was pretty amazing. We did the Bahamas or Belize every other year. So for about 10 days, we hung out with those guys and just fly fished, ate dinner, drank, did all kinds of stuff, and had a great time. And for them, it was a blast. You know, they were great, amazing time for them. And for us, it was just pretty amazing.
And the thing is, too, when, you know, I've had some, when I worked for Bass Pro Shops, I flew around with Johnny Morris, you know, a little bit. Like, I shouldn't say I flew around. Like, there, I did a couple of, when I was at Bass Pro Shops, I kind of, Johnny would need essentially like someone to, he would hire, not hire, he'd take a videographer from Bass Pro Shops, and then we would kind of almost be like his home video camera guys. You know, he'd document him just going and tarpon fishing or bluefin tuna fishing rather. And so, you know, I experienced sort of that celebrity kind of aspect. I mean, I met Tony Stewart one time, had lunch, had dinner, stayed in Johnny Morris's like cabin, with Tony, and just shooting the shit, you know, like it was very, all those things as far as like kind of melt away as far as someone's a celebrity. It's kind of really neat when you get to that point where people just start being themselves, you kind of feel like, you know? Yeah. And so I've had a few of those experiences doing my job, but you in particular have had, I would say, a lot more of those. But it's fun when that happens, when you can start seeing people just, you know, people that are kind of in the spotlight being, you know, themselves more.
Well, the difference with the outdoor stuff is it's unlike just going to shoot, do an interview or a commercial, and you meet a guy that's on set. Here, they're having a ball. You know, they're having the most amazing time. They're with some other guys that, like all the, we talked about all the videographers, have a lot in common. Other celebrities that they're hanging out and fishing with and have a really good time. So the toughest thing about a show like that is none of those guys are really getting paid to be there. And so they don't really have to do a lot. So you learn not to push them too hard. You kind of get what you can get and know that you can't ask them to do a lot of retakes, or you catch live in the moment. And there's no other, can you do that again? Can you go over here? Can I get another interview?
Right.
You get
right.
What you get. It's about making it fun for them.
Yeah, right, right. And you don't have to name names. Was there anybody that would, and I don't name names, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but was there anybody that was kind of like, you know, this person's a real pain in my arse? And I don't want you, for your career, I don't want you to name names.
You know, I will.
Oh, go ahead. Yes, please.
You have different levels of celebrity that they, most of outdoor stuff, you're dealing with sports guys or kind of country music singers. You know, that's, they're right.
Yes,
showing, like hunting and fishing.
I worked with Tracy Byrd one time.
Yeah. And so you're going to have all that. So like with Michael Keaton, even Jimmy Kimmel a little bit, it took him a little time to warm up because they're so used to being defensive with camera scam. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to be pushed too much. They don't have to be there. Jim Belushi was a little like that. But then about day three, when you're just hanging out and having fun and there's not a lot of pressure for him, that's when they loosen up.
Right on.
So those first couple of days, you stay back, you push them hard, and then you realize you have that little window where you can really get a lot, and then you back off again.
Got it. Yeah. So you're playing really a psychological game.
Anytime you deal, you know that all those guys, every guy you deal with.
Oh yeah.
Every guy you're in a boat with is a little bit psychological.
Oh yeah. I mean, even to put a mic on someone, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, when's the best time here psychologically to put a mic on this person? I mean, that happens all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, with someone who's in the public eye much more, like a Jimmy Kimmel or Michael Keaton's kind of had a reemergence, I guess, with his career, which is good to see. I've always liked Michael Keaton, but But you've been working. So this is, I've always kind of dug this guy. I've never worked with him personally or met him, you know, seen him, you know, in the flesh. But you're doing gigs with Blake Shelton more now, aren't you?
Blake's a really cool guy, down to earth.
Yeah, talk about that and how that all happened.
So there's a show, McMillan, that I work on. They're in the 11th season. Started on Great American Country, then Sportsman Channel bought the show. And then they had them over now to Outdoor Channel. It's about a ranching family in Kansas, has a big hunting operation. Tom, Jackie, and Gatlin, their son, McMillan, follows their life. So Blake is really Tom's best friend and a huge hunter, just loves to hang around hunting and hunting camps, all kinds of stuff. So before, early on, he did The Voice, it was a weird thing with him. He had a contract, couldn't really be on other shows, but he still kind of would. You know, I'm sure it was weird back in the day, showing him hunting, shooting shit. So he would come just be our camera guy. We'd pick us up on a jet someplace, come from a show. We travel to somewhere in Canada, go mule deer hunt or whatever, and he'd be a camera guy hanging out. Yeah. But definitely when been to his place several times in Oklahoma, he was really nice to invite my wife one time and shooting hunting shows there. It's got an amazing place in Oklahoma, but it's fun to be around that crowd, especially when they're down to earth and have a good time.
Yeah. That's, I think with people like, you know, Blake, that it kind of gives me hope for humanity that there's people like, you know, that can have all that. Excuse me. Gosh, goodness gracious. I had a really rough night last night.
As usual.
Not really. I mean, I've but it's for someone like, all accounts from of Blake seems like he's very down earth, you know, very humble. So when you hear of situations like that with celebrities who are, there's so much attention placed on them, but they keep their humility, you know, it's so great to hear those stories. And you were saying, I you know, grew up listening to No Doubt. I've talked to you about this. I grew up listening to No Doubt. I think Gwen Stefani is maybe, if she's not the all-time greatest front woman, I don't know. She's really close to being the greatest as far as I'm concerned. She was, her energy, she was writing those songs, you know, No Doubt songs. You listen to those old songs and she's writing them about her love affair with her bass player, with the bass player of No Doubt. And if you look back at those lyrics, she really has her heart on her sleeve, you know? And so when that piece of work that she was married to cheated on her the way that he did, you know, listen, the guy was, he was a lead singer of Bush, man, you know? And he was a very handsome guy. I mean, I can't even imagine what was happening on tour with that guy, you know? So it's like that, anyway. So it was like those were two entirely different human beings, really. And it seems like that, I know this is kind of, I'm doing like some psychoanalyzing here or whatever, and I don't even know these people, but I was a big No Doubt fan and really went as a kid, really listened to her lyrics, you know? And with Blake, it just seems like that is a much better connection there between those two. And you've seen some of that, right? When you've been over there, you've seen examples of that.
Well, just down to earth. What's funny is it's the first glimpse I had into like tabloid stuff where it's kind of like when someone has a baby, then they see all kinds of baby stuff, you know, they never noticed before. It's kind of the same thing when you've been around some people that are somewhat famous. Then you start looking at like grocery line tabloid and like this happened, and this happened. And you're like, no, it didn't.
Right.
It's so weird to like see that. It's so obvious on things like that. But both of them are a very odd couple, probably for most people. But I think it's pretty unique that they really care about each other. It's neat to see that Blake introduced her kids to all kinds of outdoor stuff. They probably wouldn't have a place to do that. it's just neat to see.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like those two together, and I'm going to be really upset if I'm a romantic down, deep down. And I would be upset to see, those two split up. I don't think there's any indications of that. But yeah, I think that's cool that you're able to, you're doing work with them. So I thought that'd be fun to share that, but I wanted to get, kind of back to like your drone work. Right. And I'm kind of annoyed that the drone has become so ingrained in the vernacular, like that's a military term, you're firing hellfire missiles from a drone, for goodness sakes. Just call them aerial cameras or something. I don't know. I just still this day, I don't like the term drone, but anyway, I think we're stuck with it.
You are.
But, the thing about doing aerial work is that it is, and I've crashed so many times, man, And so I was thinking that we had one particular instance. I believe it was on Sturgeon Bay, you and I. And so tell that story, but just go talk in general of the potential disasters that can occur doing your job. You're up there getting great stuff, but it can have a price.
Here's what's amazing. I don't know of any other thing, TV show. I'm flying the drone 6 hours a day, usually 6 days in a row, nonstop, live. I'm plugged in. A truck sees it. They switch it to me at different times. So I have 10 guys in a truck watching me fly.
Let's explain that truck. So that truck is basically, that truck's based off-site. It's in like another city, actually. The technology is incredible now, that what we're doing. Like to be able, like to be in the middle of a lake and we're able to send out a signal that the world could see is phenomenal to me. So Jeff, explain how that's possible on your end. So on our cameras, on our shoulder mount cameras, we have what's known as an encoder. That's essentially like 5 cell phones, more than that, actually. Imagine like a number of cell phones all kind of connected and sending the video signal out through a cell signal. That's how essentially the live works nowadays. And so, but Jeff's situation's a little different. How does it work on your end?
So like you said, the encoder that goes on the back of the camera, I take it off the camera. I plug in the drone to it through an HDMI cable. We've worked some of the output out from that. That signal goes live back to a studio that have switchers. They have everything else. They will cut a show together, all 10 cameras plus slow-mos they can do, plus they can, there's something called an ISO where they replay something if they need to. And the future for that is now. It's amazing, the technology. But because of that, I'm flying the whole time. They might not take me, or they might take a shot later when I'm getting a scenic, or I try and focus on boat-to-boat shots, but also guys who don't have a camera in the boat in case they catch a fish. We haven't moved the camera to them yet, so I have to think ahead a little bit and realize what's going on in the day and try to be one step ahead of the production, the crew team, that when they need me, I'm at that place.
Yeah.
So all the boats have GPS trackers on them. I know where everything's at. I have a score tracker, so I'll look to see who's doing what, kind of figure out where they're at, keep an eye on them in case they talk about them or they catch fish. Or there's another story or something else that I think would be interesting that I know the truck would like, of someone who might be not doing that great, but they're going to be in the hunt for angler of the year, or they're local, or there's another story that the talent will talk about.
Yeah.
But anyway, to get back to that, so since I'm live all day, if I crash, 10 people in the truck will go, "Oh, look at that," which is maybe happened once.
Yeah, so it can be a harrowing job here because we were, just to give you an idea. So we are you okay with me telling the story?
Bring it.
So we were on Sturgeon Bay, And we're out a ways, you know? I mean, out a ways. Lots of stuff in Sturgeon Bay is, you know, you're fishing offshore stuff. So you're fishing offshore rock piles, a smallmouth.
Super rough. Those.
Yeah.
Big waves.
Yeah, big waves. And it's a great lake, you know? So there's places there, of course, that you can't see land, you know, there's no land and you can really kind of lose where you are, especially, if you're operating a drone. And I can't remember what angler I was filming. So I'm in the boat.
Josh Bertrand.
Yes. And that, I mean, this is a great angler for this to have happened to, because Josh is super laid back and just a phenomenal dude. But so I'm filming, and then all of a sudden I hear like a swarm of bees, you know, around me, and I look back and here's this drone that seems to be just buzzing around, but kind of frantically, and I'm like, what is happening? I'm stupidly, I didn't really understand what was going on. I should have. The drone was getting closer and closer to me, and it didn't dawn on me that there was maybe an emergency situation happening. I was like ready to knock the thing out of the sky. And so you're on the other end, and what's going through your head?
So this is what happened. I'm flying around. I didn't realize our spot lock. It was so rough. I'm barely hanging on. I can barely stand up, and I'm just trying to get good shots, go around, heavy, heavy wind. They're on me live. And so finally, battery's starting to beep. I knew it was time to come back. I went back to our home point. That's where we have a little GPS tracker. Has a line that gets back to your home point. We drifted so far off, I didn't realize it, that I couldn't find us. So I went up, looked around. We drifted. I couldn't find us. So I kept going around, and we're beeping. And so when you beep, you have another maybe 4 or 5 minutes. Well, it's beeping, and it's going down. And so then I fight it back up, and it goes back down. If a drone quits, it won't just drop out of the sky. It'll slowly go down and land somewhere. Unfortunately, we're in water.
Yeah.
So the only thing I could do was find that boat. I started to go. I tried to charge it just so you guys would know to move. And you, every time I come close, you have like a life jacket. You're trying to throw on it. I have to zoom back out like, Greg, stop. And I finally get, you finally, guys, the whole crew gets it. The official is looking at me just dumbfounded as I'm about to hit himself in the head to try and make a move. I go out. Instead of move to the back, you guys all move to the front. There's a seat in the back. There's about a 2-foot little spot. In waves like this.
It was it was like an emergency landing on an aircraft carrier in the North Atlantic.
The wind's going during crazy. A storm. And so the wind's going crazy. So finally, I have 3% battery left. It's going. So I just had to go in. I land, I think. Then my screen went blank. No idea if it in the boat.
Wow.
In the water, anything else. And there's only 10 minutes left of the day. So I just waited because I didn't want to mess up his fishing until the end. And then pull up to you guys afterwards and you hand me the drone. And I went,
yeah, yeah. And that is, you know, I've crashed drones. I mean, it can be a very nerve-wracking, experience flying drones. And, would you say that is, is that like your worst situation that you've been in, or have there been others?
Maybe Lake Erie was a few years ago. They had a super tournament, and the waves were so big then that you're looking down, and I started getting a little seasick. So I would horizon, 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 fly, 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 horizon, horizon, horizon. And every time I'd come back, I'd have to stay there for about 5 seconds and not puke.
No kidding. And that's the worst thing too. Like, people don't realize if you're, you know, in the middle of the ocean or not, you don't have to be that far to be seasick. And people that say they don't get seasick, I say, well, you just haven't been in the right swells yet, you know. Like there's times when I'm absolutely fine, but the right kind of swell can just send you over the edge. And I'll never forget. I was on a shoot. I don't know where it was. I'm not going to name drop, but because it kind of sounds, you know, it was somewhere exotic, okay, and warm. but I remember just having to set cameras all over this like sport fish, you know, boat, which is like a big, it's a typical like marlin kind of boat, a big offshore center kind of it's not a console, but it's one of the, if you ever seen guys marlin fishing, it's that boat. I was in one of those boats setting cameras all up as we were going out to the spot, and we are in pretty heavy seas. And whenever you'd look down, it was when you looked down to try to do something, to set something.
Fix a microphone,
something. Yes. Yeah. That's when I would start just getting really, really queasy and then eventually just popping, you know. But yeah, so that had to be super nerve wracking. Yeah.
You learn when you're on those deep sea fishing shows, usually it's two cameras. And you learn, even if you're about to get sick, you fake it like you're not. Until last minute, because you don't want the other guy taping you as you threw up, and they will.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to me on that shoot. Yeah, yep. Some jackass. I know who he is. Rich Ross. I'll never forget Rich Ross. Yeah, got me puking. Of course, there's cameras everywhere, you know, and cameramen. So yeah, I mean, it's gonna happen.
The only time that I crashed was the first time that I flew for MLF. I've flown for FLW. Maybe 3 or 4 years. I did a lot of camera work, and then I'd fly as well. And so they had another guy fly before, and I was really getting kind of cocky. Because the truck the whole time, you're live. And you hear everyone in the truck go, oh, cool, look at that shot. Oh, cool. As you're going, and all the other camera guys, because they can hear the same feed, are sending me texts going, screw you, McMichael. And so that's edging me on more. As I'm flying, get all these amazing shots. So then I kept going, we're on Lake Fork, and the whole time I'm hearing it in the headset, look at that, the snake on camera 5. Oh, look at that moccasin on all this. They're all around, and I've seen lots of snakes. So I was coming down on Mark Daniels Jr., and I cruised through these trees, and it was kind of a risky thing. I went under this canopy, came out on the other side, got the shot. The truck all went crazy. All those guys, oh, look how cool that shot is. So I did another shot just like it. And on the way through, a vine caught the drone and stuck in the tree in a vine. I can still see it. And also then the truck erupted. Like, oh, look at that. They're all laughing. So after he left, I went over. And it's a thick canopy. I can't walk there. I can't do anything. I have to go in. I have the... and it's way up in the tree. So I'm climbing through swampy stuff, waiting for a moccasin to get me any moment. Right. Get up there and look up, and I can't climb the tree. There's vines and thorns all over it. So I took the push pole out of the boat, threw it up to break the limbs, and then it fell, and I caught it and tried not to get the head of the push pole and somehow saved it.
Like a baby, from a burning building. You caught the baby. That's amazing. So
it's the first time I got a little less cocky after that.
Yeah.
But you still have to fly and do those shots because that's what you got hired for.
Well, exactly. The other thing that I got to say, too, is that you're flying in some pretty inclement weather oftentimes. And I'm not even sure if – I mean, you're – you're testing these things to their limit, you know, and I'm not so much. I mean, I've seen you fly with some precipitation, you know, a little bit, not crazy, but I'm probably more impressed with the amount of wind that you can fly in. I mean, I don't know if it was back in the day. It was like, a certain amount of wind, you better be on the ground. It's like that has gone, at least for you, it seems, that's gone out the window. I mean, you're able to fly and get remarkable stuff in some pretty windy conditions.
You learn how to use the wind a bit, not go too high. A tip for guys, if they start to lose the drone and they just can't come back. What happens is you get a tailwind, you're hauling butt, you get pretty far away, and then you can't come back. So if you go super low to the ground, the winds aren't as high, and you can usually get back. But it's the first time you fly and it gets far back and you realize the battery's beeping, and you're going about 40 to get there, and you're going 10 miles an hour to come back. Just go low, super low to the water or the ground or wherever.
It's interesting that current in rivers operates very similarly. And probably a similar phenomenon where there's times when, you know, my trolling motor, I'm just going 100% trying to get up river, you know, upstream through heavy current. And if you're like in the middle trying to do that, you're like stopped. But you go closer into the bank, you know, and then you just start making headway up. So it's like, I think it's just the surface is slowing down the tension. It's probably the same way with current when you're getting closer to the ground. You know, there's just less. This is how I'm trying to explain it, Jeff. I don't know if there's any scientific basis to anything that you're saying right now.
Nothing whatsoever. Either one of them are close to the same.
We're trying to give somewhat, you know, helpful information here, you know, some tips. But I wanted to talk to you, like, so what are your favorite shots that you're getting out there? You know, like, especially someone with a videographer's eye, you know that what a drone is it's a flying camera. It's a flying camera. So in the hands of someone that knows camera moves, knows the power of what camera movements, what they can convey, they're even more powerful in the hands of someone like that, you know, that has the control of a drone that knows what kind of emotions can be conveyed from different kind of like camera moves. You know, like when you're pulling out, you know, with a drone, this big, wide, you know, pull out, you know, that conveys a certain kind of emotion, you know, and doing dollies or, you know, around objects and whatnot. But like, what are some of your favorite moves? And if there's any kind of tips on how people can, you know, do that, you know, that kind of stuff themselves.
Several different things to fly in a drone for a tournament, and there's a few different things. One I try and think of as a big jib. That's just an establishing shot that's going to cut to the onboard camera or something else. So a really cool reveal, a shot that might be straight down, that I slowly turn the camera, move down at the same time, and then show the boat, show the sponsors on the side, then cut to that camera. Obviously, a show that's straight ahead of what he's casting to, so you can see beds or structure or things really cool. Then certain things that you either circle around or you do reveals over trees to where they're fishing. Just something cool that sets the scene. So for us, it's a little different because there's times that they'll cut to me live. There's not another camera. They might be on me for 10 minutes. So I have to film, and it's a boring shot just from the side. So really slow dolly tracking shots, similar to an interview, that if you had one standard lock-off shot, then another shot that you wanted to slowly move because it's just more interesting. Because it could get boring just watching a shot. We don't have audio. We only have guys talking in the studio. So I need to make it like a cool dolly shot that just takes a little time, that's more interesting to look at. And it might be you listen to what they're talking to, so I'll do a slow dolly shot. They're talking about what they're talking about. I'll do a very slow shot, and there can be no bobbles. There can be, most of the time when you fly a drone, you fly fast, you get a couple shots, you set another scene, you might do that. That's for an edited project. For this, it's 10 minutes live. So all the way around, all the way up, you don't want any jerks. And that's where really people are scared to fly over water, but it's kind of nice because you don't really have to worry about a lot of trees usually. It's kind of open, so you get really good at doing really slow, smooth shots. The other thing a lot of guys do when they're recording on a drone, it's similar to still photographers who are really good, but they're used to not holding a shot for a long time. You might record something, you need a couple minutes. When it seems like you got it in about 20 seconds, keep recording because you need long ins and outs, and you might use that shot for longer than you think.
Yeah, the other thing too, it's such a remarkable angle, because with fishing, it's the playing field is underwater, obviously, right? You have to use your imagination with what the anglers, how they're really fishing. It's so important to me, to know what that angler's doing, what he's fishing, what's the layout of the topography in front of them, you know? And with that drone shot, you can get that a lot of times. If the water's clear, I mean, man, when it's clear, you can really have that laid out, which is absolutely fantastic, you know? The other thing, and you may have touched upon this a little bit, but the other thing that I think is really, seems to be happening more, which I think is really, really cool, is that you can hear, you're listening to the live show. You're listening to the live show. You're also listening to the show being directed, being, in the truck. And so you can hear what an angler might be, you know, if they're discussing how they're fishing, the area that they're fishing, the type of cover that they're fishing. If the water's really clear, the structure, there's a hump, you know, you can then... While that angler, you know, they're cutting from the camera in the boat and the angler's boat to your camera, you can be showing, focusing in on what that angler is discussing, or, you know, describing. And so that, I think, is remarkable. I think doing that is really, really adds to that live show, you know, having that ability to do that.
It's so cool to do. And it's really cool when you're up, you're getting a amazing shot. You can see what they're casting to. You get an idea that you've never seen before on how that someone picks apart an area, what the structure they're going through. You can start to read their mind a little bit. And it's neat to see that you can't see from any other perspective.
Yeah.
Especially when you follow a guy for a while.
I think the struggle with fishing, as far as, I don't care whether fishing will be mainstream. As a kid, I cared about that stuff. If anything, anymore, I don't want fishing to become mainstream, because there's going to be more pressure on the lakes. I'm like every angler, you know, like, I mean, we're friendly. Like, once you talk to other anglers, we're all friendly. But at first, when we see each other out on the water, like, get the hell off my spot. I mean, that's, you know, like, I want the fishing pressure to be lessened. But I do feel like with drones and this amazing aerial footage that, you know, you're able to capture, you're able to tell that story better. You know, you're able to tell the story that's so hard to convey in professional fishing. Like, what the hell are they actually fishing, you know? And so that that drone footage is helping to tell that story better. It's definitely been a positive in the production of, fishing television to me, because it's showing, you know, let's face it, just seeing the back of an angler fishing is not very exciting. You know, if you're an angler and hearing the soundbite of an angler, you can put yourself in that position and go, okay, I know what he's fishing, right? But someone who maybe isn't an angler or has less experience, it just helps to have that angle to go, oh, okay, you know, and just to tell that story better, to explain the playing field better. I think underwater shots can do that to a point. Mm-hmm. You know, all this technology is helping to be able to really cover fishing better. And I knew that when drones came on the scene, I was like, man, this is really going to be something to help just tell that fishing story better. But do you have anything to add to that?
Well, luckily they look so good and so cool. Because can you imagine? You're competing for $100,000, $150,000, depending on what's going on. You're struggling. It's tough. You have to make some decisions. And then you have this flying around your head as you're trying to concentrate. That would be tough to do. And luckily, I don't get too much flack from most of the anglers. And you kind of know when to back away a little bit and when you really need to come in. But you were, that would it's be like, you're tough to deal with.
I mean, you're reading my mind, because that was like my the next thing I wanted to ask you is that, you know, like, so I'm it's you're when you're filming these anglers and they're doing well, you're going to expect to have a drone show up, you know, and most of these guys, I would say, don't have an issue with it. Especially if they know how great the shots are and, you know, I think how they really make the live show a better show and just the edited show, everything, and just in general better. But some of these guys don't give a crap about any of that, you know. They're just, I mean, it's amazing to me how some of these anglers, you know, not the young ones so much. I guess it's probably more the old school anglers really don't, I don't know. They don't have an appreciation for it, but there's I've witnessed some anglers like just they can't stand it, and so that is further like stress upon you, you know, having to deal with that. But are there like probably don't go into the anglers that, you know, are not great. But there who are I guess let's put it this way: who are your favorite anglers to work with, and without maybe naming names, like. Have you had people like wave you off, right? And like, you know, and like
there definitely has been.
Yeah. What's that like?
Well, first, it's always guys here fishing super shallow. And most of the time I kind of know. So I'll stay, luckily with the new drones, we have a little more of a zoom. We stay a little farther back. But it's one of those where you make that first mistake because I didn't realize how they're fishing, or I didn't realize they're fishing so shallow. Might be like on a bank that looks steeper, fly from real far away, come in, and then all of a sudden you see them look up and give you the look. There's two things they do. They might not give you, if they give you the double look, you have the drone come in, and sometimes just they'll check it out just because they're surprised by it, they look back. If they do this look, then you know you might need to back
up. Right. Yeah.
But so David Dudley loves a drone. There's a couple different people. For some reason, always catch a fish when I fly the drone over. John Cox loves a drone. Every time I've ever flown on John Cox, he's caught a fish. It's weird.
That's why he loves the drone.
So Dudley will wave me on when he sees. For some reason, it's kind of lucky. And so I also play it up a bit. I did the same thing as when I was a camera guy. I would get on a guy's boat, and you never want to be the unlucky camera guy. Or what happens to a camera guy, you get on his boat, last time you're with him, he was awful, so he'll tease you about being the unlucky camera guy. They're kidding, but they're not kidding in some ways.
Right, yes.
So I used to always get on. I'm like, man. So, you know, on my last 100 guys I've been on, 60 of them have won the tournament. And they're like, really? Damn, he's lucky camera guy. And then you get the reputation, and it's all BS. I don't know how many.
Yeah.
I was with a lot, whatever. But from that point on, they'll give you a lot more stuff on camera. You know, they're good. It's the same way with a drone. So I think I'm gonna start telling guys. You know, every time I'm with David Dudley, who else? A few other guys. Wesley Strader, I usually do pretty good with too.
Wesley is good with the drone?
Yeah.
Yeah, Wesley's great. All those guys are great that you mentioned.
There's a couple guys who weren't good with the drone who, you know, I learned to stay off a little bit. But then sometimes I have to. I have to get close. I'm on live. They're talking about them. They're doing good. They don't have another camera. Or what's even worse, they're doing bad. They're supposed to do good. So they don't have a camera, and they want me to get a couple shots of them just so they can talk about it. That's when it's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, no doubt. I find it's remarkable to me that there's people that are, you know, that are superstitious. They, you know, they think things can be bad luck. You know, I'm always amazed by that. I really, really am. But I don't know. I find myself in situations where it's uncomfortable because the angler thinks that cameramen are bad luck. But I try to let them know that I've been with winning anglers before, and I'm very good luck, and that helps at times.
Doesn't help. You get on the boat, you're eating a banana. Man, last two guys I went with all lost. They're supposed to win. Really sucks. Yeah, you should try that next time.
Okay, I'll give that a shot. I wanted to ask you, like, so modern drones. So you're flying a Mavic, right? So the Mavic is, man, the Mavic 3
right now.
The Mavic is an incredibly capable drone. Like it's an amazing piece of equipment. But how long can you have that in the air? Like, how often are you doing battery changes? How many batteries? Just some of the logistics of what you do. Like, you know, how many batteries are you bringing out there? What do you have to bring out on the water? You're a one man band essentially. You know, what do you have to bring out there to be able to do your job in a day?
So I have 8 batteries, and if I only had just those, I'd go through that quick. You know, usually a battery for the Mavic 3, and the reason we use the Mavic 3, the Inspire 2 is a really great drone. It's a little noisier, bigger. It's nice to have the Mavic 3 on the boat. It's not quite as obtrusive to the guys. It's a little quieter going around guys, which is nice. So a battery will last about 30, they say 40 minutes, but really kind of around 30-ish, maybe a little less sometimes, depending on the wind. I have a whole camera battery charging station in the back. I have an inverter that I hook up to one of the boat batteries. So the inverter, I now have something, I forget what it's called. It's another little charger. It charges that. I plug all the batteries into that. I have 3 battery chargers that are going nonstop, and I have to charge my controller all day long. And so if you get behind on those, you're in trouble. So I try and stay on my battery charging unit all day long. And I'll go through on a busy day 8 batteries quick. So I have to always, as soon as I land, take the battery out, take my charger, put those on charge, put the battery on charge, and then look to see where I'm going for the next guy.
Right on. What are your, so obviously, you know, we had, I guess, I want to say, I don't know, it had to be around 2007, 2008, when you had just all kinds of remarkable things happening in television production. You know, like what I said earlier, drones, GoPro cameras, big sensors. What do you think? What are kind of your predictions for the future? Like, where are we headed with just television production in general, but especially as it pertains to like outdoor production, fishing production, you know, covering fishing tournaments?
It is so weird because it's a weird time. The landscape is changing on how we consume media, how we watch outdoor stuff. You know, all the major networks are having scared to death because they don't know what to do. So many people unplugged, so many people watching on social media stuff. The footage might not be quite as great, but it's also pretty unique because it's firsthand, or guys can do pretty amazing things with a relatively cheap budget. You know, all the social media fishing stuff, you know, you have your selfie, you have different things. I think they're going to have to expand on that. People get kind of sick of that after a while. I think they will. There'll be something new around. But I don't know. None of the networks know. They don't know what to do either, which is a scary time for us too. The difference between guys who have to really hustle, basically, if you know how to tell a story, you have the background on knowing how to put things together, you can survive in this kind of arena of just knowing how to tell a story. Or it's easy to rest on your laurels and, you know, you buy the really expensive stuff, you charge them a bunch, and then that work slowly is going away. So adapting is kind of the key to stay in this type of lifestyle and career that we've chosen.
Yeah, no doubt. What's remarkable to me is the internet, social media. It's almost like the name social media is not, it's not, uh, I don't know. It's not the right term. It's a new media. It's new media. And what I found is it's crazy going on right now with Instagram. Facebook's doing it. I mean, they have their own version of Reels, but it's the Reels. It's the short vertical video. You know, it's these. So Instagram, Facebook, YouTube are competing against TikTok because TikTok in these short vertical videos is just slamming everybody. It's like the popularity of that format is just out of control. And so what you see with Instagram, I've got a video that's over 350,000 views, and that's never happened to me since I've jumped into this world. And it's a video, a vertical video, and it's less than a minute long, but it gives you an idea. It's guys idling through a very shallow area. And there's water hyacinths around, and they're kind of going through a shortcut, you know, but what I think the common denominator there, is that it's this first person view shot, right? And you're giving people a glimpse into a world they're not familiar with. And so we all, especially if we're as videographers, we're going to unique places, we're meeting unique people, we're, you know, I've kind of learned that first person, I don't know if it's because of the gaming culture, but that first person view is very immersive. And the fact that you don't have to turn the camera, it's just already in your hand. And then boom, you have a window into someone's life different than your own. And it's like, wow, this is what someone's doing in this part of the world. You know, that is a huge part of what I think is going on there with TikTok. And so if it's something really, if it's something really unique or really interesting, then you have your views. It seems that way on Instagram. With YouTube, when I do a video like that, I'm getting way more views, but there seems to be a cap that happens. There's a ceiling it hits. Instagram, not so much. That video that's over 350,000 views, it's keep going. And so seeing that happen like that, that in filming that way, Jeff, like filming in that, it's like we've got to get away from that 16:9 notion, you know, that landscape notion, because that's what TVs look essentially, right? Well, that's just one aspect now of how people are watching media. So much of it is with their phones, and it's just, if it's right there, they don't have to turn the phone. And I've had to rethink so much, dude. It's remarkable to me what's going on there.
Super hard to do that. I think part of it is it seems authentic. Even on those videos, if you know they're kind of faking it or whatever, it's how they do it. It's kind of authentic. You know, for most of our careers, especially in some of the outdoor stuff, a lot of them are almost glorified infomercials. You know, we have lots of product, and in order to get to places, we had to sell and get in the show. A lot of great sponsors who, you know, part of it was showcasing their stuff. So we did these amazing stuff, but we're also really talking about that, their gear. So to have a true life experience that doesn't look like it's made up, it's just how a person's reacting to something. I can see why there's someone would want to go towards that a little bit.
Yeah.
There is something still of making something so cinematic. It's either you have to make it so cinematic, it's beautiful to watch. There's tons of companies that are doing that for social media, some really great movies. I used to do a lot of work for Patagonia. They do amazing stuff. They spend a lot of money on some of those. Yeti was doing the same thing. So it either has to look so beautiful you really want to watch and interesting, or such a first-person unique thing that just seems authentic.
It's one of these things where, part of it is you're wrestling with the algorithm and what the algorithm's promoting more, right? So you're really a slave to the algorithm, because if they're not going to push your stuff out there, then you're screwed, you know. But Instagram and YouTube, because they're competing with TikTok right now, are really pushing your stuff out there. But what's interesting though is that you're saying that stuff, and it does. There's stuff on YouTube. I'll just focus on YouTube. There is amazing production going on YouTube, and they can, and those channels can do very, very well, right? So that's, but then there's channels, I'm telling you, man, like, especially in the fishing realm, where, I mean, dude, it is one camera and it is like no production. And mm-hmm. so there's also an aspect of YouTube where it is social. It's just like, it's not about, it's, we have in our heads that it's got to be about like, we're old school, right? So it's like when you're making a show, it's like everything's perfect, sounds perfect. You, everything's, you know, you're telling a really well-told story. Well, mm-hmm. there's an aspect of YouTube where it's like, no, I just want you to tell me what you're like. Let's say take fishing just for example. I just want you to take me along on your fishing day and we can talk about it in the comments, and maybe we can, you know, we can get together and fish sometime, and I do videos, and there's no kind of, there's, it's very simple, and it's more of just a social thing back and forth, and it's more about like just putting up content, and that it's bizarre. I've tried to just condense what's happening into really more digestible, like easier to understand like concepts, but I can't because there's, it's the YouTube and the internet is, and it's an infinity, it's worth of different possibilities. They're ASMR videos, for example, like, There's genres that have not even been thought up yet that people are like, you know, yeah, you know what? I'll watch a cute girl making strange, soothing voices and sounds. Yeah, she strokes a blanket, you know, like that's YouTube. And, and yet those people, there's people that are making a living off of that. So there's, it's all over the place, dude. Like it's a crazy time to be alive.
I just want to see a real person. I can see guys. How does he use a topwater there? That's all I want to see. I don't want to see some big thing that I don't know if I trust or not trust because they're sponsors. How does he throw a jerk bait there? And I think there's some of that that goes on that looks a little more raw. And then I might find another video of a pro doing, but at least I've seen what like a regular guy does. Not someone who's really, really good.
Yeah.
I can see that happening.
Yeah, it's, I would have never, there. I get upset with myself sometimes, like, man, I wish I would have got on board this thing when it, you know, like when YouTube first started. Those people are just, when they, you know, those guys are doing very, very well now, you know, the early adopters of YouTube. But the reality is there was no way I could have predicted this. No way. What I predicted, these kids putting up like home videos, very basic videos of just them out fishing in their local pond and them becoming YouTube superstars. I would have never, I don't know how anybody could have predicted any of that, you know? So good for those guys. It is what it is. In many ways, I'm very excited about all of it because I like the idea. I've said this a billion times. I love the idea that you can be your own boss. You can, if you believe that, you know, something, you want to put your own stuff out there, and if you have the ability to grow an audience and make money and potentially do it for a living, that to me is phenomenal. That's really exciting to me. I love that exists now, but it's just the algorithm. Your algorithm's no good here. The algorithm is what can be one of the frustrating aspect of it. You really got to learn the game and learn how. If you're never going to grow your audience if you don't get big views. And sometimes you have to play this really ridiculous trending game with YouTube in particular. It's like, oh, because these big YouTube fishing channels like to do videos around spillways, every video now I have to do has to be fishing under a spillway. You know, and that's, if I have a criticism about the YouTube game, it's that kind of stuff, you know. But and that's all algorithm based. But I don't want to keep you much longer. I appreciate you doing this very much, dude. I really, really do. But I did want, like, you've been in the bass fishing game. You've been in the video production game. Both of those things for many, many years now. Just what are your thoughts in general? Number one, about where we're going with the production side of bass fishing. But then just number two, the sport in general. What do you think the future holds? Where we are now and what do you think the future holds?
So the live stuff is pretty interesting. You know, for me, when a guy, it's hard for me to imagine anyone watching that much. We do 6 days in a row, sometimes 8 hours a day, which seems crazy. But I know guys go in and out. There's guys, it's amazing. Every camera boat driver I ever have tells me they watch it all day long. They keep it in the background. They're listening to me, which is amazing to me. So the live stuff will always be there. I think it's expected now. How many cameras, how many days, that'll change. Being in the sport for a long time, since my first outdoor stuff was 1995, there's been a lot of incarnations where the sport was going to take off to the next biggest thing. I don't know if it'll ever really get to where people hope it will get, but the one thing that I've seen started in 2010, I used to help produce the first college fishing shows. And the amount of high school and college anglers that they might not continue doing the sport forever, but they've done it enough that they're interested and they're still watching is huge. And it's growing and it's growing. So that is the only thing, not the TV production, anything else. This huge youth movement is a big deal. So I see that taking the sport to a different level.
Yeah, I agree. I got into bass fishing because I learned about the Bassmasters. Bob Cobb was the producer back in the day. This was late 80s, early 90s. Late 80s is when I first learned about the Bassmasters.
But amazing shows at the time.
I was addicted. It was on the Nashville Network. I was addicted to it. That's how I got into bass fishing and competitive fishing, is because I learned about that TV show. I think the same thing is happening. I know it's happening with what we're doing, Major League Fishing, your amazing shots you're getting with the drone. All of that production, to someone who is interested in fishing, seeing that, it's sparking the fire of a whole new generation. You know, we're not seeing it because we're in the thick of it. We're producing that stuff. We're making that content. But I have no doubt that we are developing a new generation of people that are going to be eaten up with bass fishing, with competitive fishing. You see it with this new crop of anglers. You know, all of that is, it's not like television has a huge part in that, in that passion, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think the more young anglers you have coming up, probably more so than there's ever been, they'll come into positions of kind of power in the industry, and we'll constantly be getting better. You know, we'll have more people in the industry that are really, really passionate about the sport of professional bass fishing, be making better decisions about it. I just think in general, because it's still, you know, you still have, I mean, it's not a mainstream sport. There's not as many people. It's not like golf. It's not like, you know, so I just think the more people that that are eaten up with it, that are, you know, that there's, it's just going to, not just in the tournament aspect of things, as far as having young people competing, it's also going to be the guys that just grew up with the show that are, they're like me. You know, like I was eaten up with the Bassmasters, and now, you know, my career has basically been focused on promoting fishing, and, you know, and so I think that it's just going to be with what we're doing, more young anglers getting involved. I think it's going to improve just fishing in general, I guess, is what I'm
in 5 years. You watch how cutthroat the MLF is. So it's even got to, like, you know, the guys getting out. You're going to have this new crop of guys. It's going to be phenomenal the amount of fishing and how good those guys are, how intense those shows are going to be.
And I think, I agree. No, I agree. Go ahead.
The shows that are really going to showcase more than anything else are these team series that we're doing. You know, I didn't know how they're going to go, but listening to that feed, for people who don't know, the new team series for Major League Fishing, they take three pros. They're all on a team. They compete against other pros, and they're talking to each other all day long. And you really hear how someone breaks down all those things I thought anglers were crazy before, when the angler would drive by them and you see them hide their reels and what they're using. I always thought they were crazy and paranoid. But listening to it, it's true. Those guys are looking what other guys are fishing, how they're fishing, what they're doing. You know, it's not like the guy catches a fish and talks about his bait that everyone knows he uses. He's talking to other guys to really dial in an area. And you're learning so much. Those shows are going to be phenomenal.
Yeah, that I started realizing. I told Randy White, he's the producer of the team series of Major League Fishing. And I mean, he does a phenomenal job. He's my boss, so I have to say this, but he's also my friend. But I told him, I said, you know, I had some reservations at first about the team series. You know, I was a little worried, would the headsets be clunky? You know, the communication between the anglers. Dude, and Randy does this all the time, man. But like, he had that thing that was dialed. I was blown away with how good the communications were between the anglers. And then, you know, they were also listening to the conversations going on between the anglers all day. So they're jotting those conversations down to keep record so that they could edit pieces together later for the edited show, you know, revolving around those conversations, because those conversations so many times were so good to illustrate how the anglers were fishing. You know, and as a viewer, it allows you to understand. You can glean information to potentially make yourself a better angler from that. You know, how they're setting up, how they're working a particular area, the lures that they're using to catch fish. So I really praised everybody involved, you know, after that first season, because, you know, with this concept, because it and just to see the camaraderie too that would develop.
So cool.
You know, it's very exciting. I think it really plays in well for the Every Fish Counts, the score tracker, all of that stuff. Like I've said this to Randy even recently. I told him, you know, as far as that move to five fish, I know some people in the organization, just in general, fans, or they're apprehensive about going back to five fish. This organization can still do Every Fish Counts for the cup of, or the team series events, for the specialty events. You know, this Major League Fishing is more than just Every Fish Counts. The score tracker, the fact that all the anglers know how their competition is doing, is huge. I cannot emphasize that enough. It's huge.
Absolutely.
Okay? And the other thing that's very, very important is these periods, right? So the fact that there is a set time when the competition is over, so you get these amazingly dramatic moments that happen, doesn't happen in other organizations. And a perfect example was Chris Lane winning the first Bass Pro Tour this year. I mean,
so cool.
You don't have anything like that anywhere else. You know, he came from behind minutes to go, that one fish right at the end with a time limit on it. And so it's like, Major League Fishing, please don't think that everything is every fish counts. It's not. There's a lot more that this organization has going for it. And that, you know, that whole five fish thing, going back to five fish and having that dramatic of an ending on the first Bass Pro Tour event, that to me just is like, yes, this thing still got it, you know? Like, this Major League Fishing still got something very special here. It's not just Every Fish Counts.
Even the pros, I was really curious how it was going to work out. There's still tons of drama, still guys catching fish the last minute, still fish up on those cut days. They were really exciting. You know, I thought it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I did as well. It was a fun tournament. So, well, my friend, I will let you go. I actually have to get a snowblower fixed.
Can you see out the windows how nice it is here?
It's actually everything's relative, right? It's actually a beautiful day. I'm looking out the window right now. I mean, it's sunny out, but it's maybe 32. I mean, you know, technically at 32, you learn this stuff as a Minnesotan. At 32, water can exist in both a liquid and a solid state. So you're kind of like 32, you know. I'm hoping it gets to 33 because then there'll be some melt going on. So that's what it's like living up here, dude.
True.
But, so I got to get the snowblower fixed because, we still have a month left, probably a month and a half when it could still snow. So got to get the snowblower fixed. But I appreciate it very much, dude. I know I give you a hard time because I have to carry this stupid camera on my shoulder all day. I'm a glutton for punishment. I still love it. But what you're doing is absolutely phenomenal work. It's gorgeous stuff. And we've worked together for many, many years. And I've always admired your work. And I continue to admire it. With you in the air now.
That's great. Thanks. It was great being with you. And we didn't even talk about New Orleans, so that's good.
Yes, maybe for another day.
Good.
Jeff, take care, my friend. I always enjoy talking with you.
Sounds good. I'll see you next week.
Red Crest, here we come.
All right.